Brothers and sisters in Christ who know why it is a Merry Christmas. I suppose you know the song, God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen. You've sung it, Christmas Carol. But it doesn't mean exactly what we think it means in modern American English. In fact, the term Merry is different, and so is the concept of rest. Rest is probably what you think you'll do after you get done with the service here, unless, of course, you still watch the green and gold. It's when you go and have a nap. Some people start early in church, I've noticed. In fact, it doesn't mean rest, but it means make. God make. It's the old English form. You rest on something. It is a process of it becoming a part of you. And then the term Mary actually comes from the Old English. It is the concept of like Robin Hood's merry men. It wasn't that they were so jovial. It was that they were so skilled and capable, what we would call mighty men. So in the Old English, a ruler that was a mighty ruler was called a merry ruler. A singer was a merry singer. An army was a merry army. It's a strange way of looking at things. But in actuality, this is what the original song meant. When people fully understand the context of these lyrics, they might even designate God Rest You Merry Gentlemen as one of the more profound, meaningful hymns. What does it mean? Why should you not be dismayed? That first verse goes on. For Jesus Christ our Savior was born on Christmas Day to save us all from Satan's power, ere we had gone astray. O tidings of comfort and joy. O tidings of comfort and joy. So very loudly, this hymn or carol has proclaimed that Jesus is our strength. Only when we're connected to Him do we have the comfort and joy of Christmas. And I ended on Christmas Day with a mighty Christmas to you. That's what this is about. Is God make you mighty, my good and gentle friend? You might say, well, what does this have to do with Christmas? Because Jeremiah is tied up in this, it was the concept of the shepherds, the leaders of the children of Israel, that were letting the people down. They had failed. And you can actually relate to this because we put so much stock in the leadership of a nation, of a church or a corporation, of a family, it might be father, that has let us or let others down. And every day you see the news of someone who has failed miserably. And reminds you, doesn't it, of when Jesus would come to the shore of the Sea of Galilee and he would see the people and say, they were like sheep without a shepherd. Lost sheep in need of being saved. So the celebratory sounds of God Rest You Merry Gentlemen was established by Queen Elizabeth. It had been around for hundreds of years, but she enjoyed the strength of the song, and that's what we'll look at today in Jeremiah. On the insert, you'll see the 3 points. God promised, I will gather them around my chosen shepherd. Israel and us are often more parallel than we'll admit. We like to have a say, a part in who leads us. We would like to know that they are working for our good. In fact, a lot of people in America today will classify the leader, might be a president, governor, somebody in the local government, according to how well that person has gotten their things done. And more often than not, that has to do with things like the economy, or my own set of morals or preferences. In fact, I think we need something more than the kind of presidents that we elect, the governors. you will find very frequently that about the time that they are able to do one part of the equation you like, something else bothers you. There is no perfect leader, even when you elect them. You might put all your stock in them, saying, if we get him elected, then everything will be all right. And every time, you're going to be disappointed in a human shepherd. In fact, Jesus wasn't the same as these kind of leaders. God said, I will raise up to David a righteous branch, a king who will reign wisely and do what is just and right in the land. Do you see how what we often are looking at in our local area and government is short-term? It's sort of like the satisfaction we get out of a day of Christmas, opening packages. And then we're not so happy anymore. We looked perhaps to something like that for a long-term effect that it couldn't accomplish. But when Christ comes, who is the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, he lifts us above that because he is not a mortal ruler. In fact, I hope you've heard this said before. It's a quote that was given, no matter who the president is in our country, Jesus is still king. Doesn't that make sense? That there's a higher government, there's something long-term that we find our security in. And when we hear this in the prophet already proclaimed, we are encouraged. So Jeremiah for us is going to take us to the very heart of Christmas, what God was doing in the manger of giving us a child ruler who would grow up. He amazed his parents. He amazed the people in Jerusalem at 12. He will amaze them even more by the time he's 30, 31, and 32. You know, we are more familiar with commanders and generals than we are with pastors and shepherds in America. In fact, I think many times the ruler that people would like is one with power, with pomp. And the quiet of a shepherd seems too lowly. But God has manufactured or arranged his leadership around the pasture, around the caring nature. Listen to what he says in Jeremiah. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says to the shepherds who tend my flock, because you have scattered my flock and driven them away and have not bestowed care on them. You see, that's what he's looking for. He's looking for kindness, compassion, and he had to do it himself. He had to choose one who would bring that kind of a rule, the one that would be different than all others. How many of you watched White Christmas during this Christmas cycle? White Christmas, the Bing Crosby? It's kind of an old classic, isn't it? In that old classic, when he's done with his service, General Waverly is kind of pushed aside by a very pompous official general who knows better and is going to get the troops back in line. In fact, the reason that there is such a celebration on his behalf up in the mountains of Maine was because he was a compassionate, kind leader. It was because he was the kind of leader that the men really wanted, that was worried about their lives, about getting them home, about protecting them, where the other general was just worried about his four stars. Part two says that we have a king that has already been established. The verse, late in verse 6, I will raise up to David a righteous branch. I don't know about you, but I don't really care for branches all over my property. It happened this year. I tried to treat my trees, and after a year, I was a year behind everybody else. All my ash trees are dead. So you know what I think about ash branches? Throw them in a pile and burn them. Although the last round, I had a chipper come in because we had a big 65-foot tree and had to have a bucket and had it taken down. Actually, that's all they're really good for. You know, and that's how we look at it. The branches, why does God use this kind of an analogy? The righteous branch. Let me explain it and then quote a couple of passages. In Jeremiah, he says, in those days and at that time, I will make a righteous branch sprout from David's line. He will do what is just and right in the land. Then in Zechariah, he says, I bring up my servant, the branch. And in Isaiah, a shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots, a branch will bear fruit. The word branch in Hebrew is netzer. And you may not catch this, but Jesus was from Nazareth. Nazareth, the branch. In Matthew 2, he came and dwelt in a city called Nazareth, that it might be fulfilled what was spoken by the prophets. He will be called a Nazarene. Did you know that that's an actual prophecy of this linkage to the righteousness of God? Now, obviously, a righteous branch is very important to God. We might wonder why. Dig a little deeper in these texts and you'll find out, because it's from the roots. It is from David's line that this all occurs. And why that's important is that that shows his credentials. If somebody comes to your door and says they're a police officer, you're not going to believe them. And I know some of you are skeptical enough to say, well, show me. Especially if it was a detective in plain clothes. You would wait until that badge was out there, and then you'd probably even look closer, ask to hold it, look at it, and determine for yourself, is this person credentialed to stand here and make these comments to me about his authority? When Jesus came, his credentials were 300 strong. 300 prophecies had been made about where he was going to be born, how he would enter, what would happen in the surrounding history, the coming of the Magi, the coming of Herod's displeasure, the raging of and ravaging of the babies at Bethlehem, and on through until you would see how he was going to be killed, in what place and in what time, under what rule. All of those prophecies were part of the credentialing that God gave out of the roots of David, would come one to me who will be that king that I have appointed. I guess the world looks at maybe what they want to hear. They often will find a teacher that they desire, that has the ring of truth. His name was Siddhartha, born many centuries ago. You probably don't recognize his official name. Siddhartha was a great teacher among men, but there were no prophecies of his coming. He rose up and took over a whole Eastern culture. He became the teacher, we would call them gurus, that everyone began to follow. And then after his death, he was immortalized and literally worshipped as a god. His name in the Eastern cultures is Buddha. But there was no credential of the kind that that Jesus has. There was no credential of promise after promise of thousands of years of his arrival. You see, Jesus is different. The Prince of Peace offers a leadership that has a different background. He rules wisely. You take Psalm 23, and the reason it's so dearly loved is because it ties to this shepherd leadership. The Lord's my shepherd, I shall not want. And at the very end it says, surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life through the shepherd's care. And then, thirdly, in this final passage in verse 6, in his days Judah will be saved and Israel will live in safety. This is the name by which he will be called, the Lord our righteousness. I put the Hebrew up there, Yahweh, and you'll see a connection here that was kind of a play on words. One of the last kings of Israel was Zedekiah. You probably have heard the term Melchizedek in the book of Hebrews. That means king of righteousness. Zedek at the end of that is righteous. So when you have Zedekiah, you have Zedah, the righteous one, and then the AH is Yahweh. That's an indicator of God. So it means the Lord, Yahweh, is righteous. But it's a play on words because Zedekiah was the exact opposite. He was a really bad king. He was a not-so-wise leader that had really wrecked the leadership and rule. He was one of those unfaithful shepherds. When we use the term the Lord our righteousness, what we're talking about is an external concept. When most people, and this is very true of our culture, will say, that will answer the question, how do you expect to get into heaven? It hasn't changed in all my years of ministry. People still say the same thing as they did to the Kennedy explosion questions. We would go and on the street, we would ask, if you expect to get into heaven, what will God rate you on, or how will God open the door to you? And their answer then was, I think I've lived a good enough life. I hope I've done more good than bad. It still is the exact answer, and sometimes that's the answer I get from my own members. And you think to yourself, where did you miss the Lord, our righteousness? You cannot qualify. It is not a positive thing to say he's very self-righteous. That's not a good thing. Because we cannot, and we know innately, deep down inside, our righteousness will never accomplish what God is looking for. In fact, you have to have what I call a cover letter. During middle of November, we had a arrival of a guest. It was about 2 days before she came, and she stayed 2 nights with us. My best friend is a pastor up at Hayward. His daughter is an equine doctor. She's actually graduated from UW-Madison, and she's trying to get a residency to become an equine surgeon. She is now on her third try. She happens to be an intern at Belmont in Queens, New York, because she was number two twice. Not one, but two, and hasn't gotten the residency. So she was given an opportunity to fly back and come here to interview with and get a letter of recommendation from the head of the equine program at UW-Madison. When you have that, you're almost guaranteed an in. We're still holding on to the hopes that she'll be able to make it because there's a point of no return. As an intern, she gets paid about a fifth of what she'd get paid as a doctor. And in fact, she's hoping to accomplish that through the signing of the letter by her friend, the professor who's in charge. And even he doesn't have complete authority in the selection. That's why she has to come back another time. You see, there's really only one cover letter, one decent or perfect life that covers. And in that letter, when you face God as judge, it's all you need. Maybe you've heard this story before. A man had a dream, and it started off, he said, as a nightmare. I found myself sucked down through one of those lengthy, it felt like I was in an air tube, and I arrived at the doorstep of a courtroom and was drawn into the defendant's chair. Very quickly, I realized it was me who was on trial. And he said, in looking around the room, I did not see a lot of favor or friendliness. In fact, when he looked at the prosecutor, he said, this was the most evil face I have ever seen. Sitting next to him was his defense attorney, quietly, kind of almost unconnected. He looked over and he said, there's something familiar about him, but I don't really know how he's going to defend me. As the court proceeded, the doors flung open and all of the people rose as the judge arrived. He was a powerful, fearsome type of individual, and everybody paid attention when he rang the gavel and said, let's begin. The prosecutor hit full stride. He said, my name is Satan, and I have a few things to say here. His list was long. It was as if everything that he had ever thought or done wrong was going to be listed that day. All of his greed, all of his jealousy, all of the desire for things he could not or should not have ever wanted. But it was all there, placed on record before him. And the judge began to just shake his head because it was so bad that at the very end, Satan's closing arguments were this. He said, there is no one who can say that this person should be guilty of anything less than death, eternal death in hell. And then the judge turned and said, do you have any defense? The defense attorney was quiet for a long time. And the man said, I was feeling so guilty, I couldn't even lift my head and look at everyone around. They now knew everything that was wrong with me. I had no chance. I am doomed. But the defense attorney, when he strode to the bench, actually looked a little more familiar. He realized it's the son, and the judge is the father. They look a lot alike, and he heard the defense attorney say, "Father, I have a reason for not making him pay." And he turned around and he explained very quickly that these holes on my hand have already accomplished the sentence. There is no more payment that can be made. Yes, he's guilty. Yes, he deserves to die. Yes, it's a death sentence. But it has already been served. There is nothing else that needs to be done. I've done it all. You see, there it is. The cover letter of God. In the person, the flesh and blood, and the literally the righteousness of Christ. It's there that we find our satisfaction. That's what makes it a good Christmas. That's what makes it a mighty Christmas. It's not because we can rest now, we have nothing more to do. It's that God has provided salvation once for all. This is what made it a mighty Christian church. They understood the power of that death and resurrection. They understood that the righteousness of Christ had been accomplished for them. And with that, we go home during this quiet time after Christmas. And we remember again, it doesn't matter whether we got every present we wanted, whether everybody came, whether everybody smiled. "God rest ye merry gentlemen" really means "God make you mighty, gentle friend." Our shepherd, our gentle one, who came to give us eternity, has arrived. Amen.